The headlines. Day 26 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Kiev announces a deal on 8 humanitarian corridors from besieged areas that exclude the port city of Mariupol. A senior European Union diplomat says the bloc will discuss an oil embargo on Russia during talks with its allies later this week. And Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the nation's resistance last year led to the U.S. suffering a humiliating defeat in its maximum pressure campaign. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Russian military operation in Ukraine is in its 26th day. Ukrainian authorities say both sides have agreed to create 8 humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from besieged towns and cities. Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk says the agreement does not cover Mariupol. She added that efforts to reach the volatile city with humanitarian supplies have led nowhere. Moscow has set a deadline for Kiev to surrender the city. Russia has also promised safe passage to Ukrainian nationalists in Mariupol, provided they lay down their arms. Kiev, however, has rejected Russia's demands. It says giving up the city is out of the question. Russia also keeps pounding other parts of Ukraine. At least 6 people were killed in overnight bombing in the capital, Kiev. The city's mayor says shelling has hit residential houses and a shopping district. The Russian military also hit a Ukrainian army facility in Rivne region with cruise missiles. We've talked to our correspondent, Robert Carter, who's currently in the Polish city of Lublin. He's told us about the refugee crisis caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Well, as it was predicted by many, more than 2 million Ukrainians have now entered into Poland. So that's the single biggest number of refugees that one country has taken in so far. And obviously it's put tremendous strain on Poland, but there is a massive effort here to cater for all of these new guests, and that effort is still underway. But as for the situation, obviously the fighting is still ongoing, and the more fighting that occurs and the more the situation in Ukraine escalates, the greater the refugee crisis will inevitably be, as there are still, I believe, somewhere about 6.5 million Ukrainians that are actually displaced inside Ukraine, mostly moving over to the western part of Ukraine, which hasn't been so heavily hit by the military operations. That, of course, if it does expand, then, of course, those refugees might decide, you know what, we actually want to get out of Ukraine completely and flee either towards the west, or more refugees could indeed flee actually into Russia itself from the eastern part as well.
Elsewhere, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky renews his plea for talks with his Russian counterpart, saying negotiations are the only way to end the war.
I am ready for negotiations with him. I was ready over the last 2 years. And I think that without negotiations, we cannot end this war.
Zelensky noted that if there is a, quote, just 1% chance to stop the war, we need to take this opportunity to talk to the Russian president. In an exclusive interview with CNN, the Ukrainian president also warned of a possibility of a third world war if such attempts fail. He blamed Russian forces for what he called exterminating and killing Ukrainians. Zelensky's call for talks comes amid accusations that Russia is committing war crimes in Ukraine. Officials in Kiev claim anti-Ukrainian forces have bombed a school sheltering some 400 people in the besieged city of Mariupol. An oil embargo on Russia over its military campaign in Ukraine tops the agenda of the talks between the European Union governments and their allies later this week. A senior EU diplomat says this is part of a new round of sanctions the bloc is preparing against Moscow. They will be discussed during upcoming summits of NATO and the group of 7 major economies. The US and the UK have already targeted the Russian oil, but the EU countries are yet to agree on similar measures. Some, such as Lithuania, support sanctioning Russian energy as a logical step. Others, including Germany and Bulgaria, are calling for caution. France, which holds the rotating presidency of the EU Council, says there should be no taboos in terms of sanctions. If the situation in Ukraine worsens, Russia is the EU's largest supplier of energy. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about this week's summits and potential European sanctions against Russia in the energy sector.
So there will be a couple of big summits at least this week. Later on in the week, we'll have a NATO summit, but also EU leaders will meet here in Brussels. And what's happening today is you have like a series of meetings. At one point, you will have three sets of ministers from the EU meeting at the same time together, and that would be the EU foreign ministers, EU defense ministers, and EU affairs ministers. And they're basically meeting to lay the groundwork for decisions that will be taken by the 27 heads of government when they meet at the summit on Thursday here. And Josep Borrell, he's the EU's foreign policy chief, and very just within the past hour, he entered the meeting to sort of chair the foreign affairs element to it as well. And he talked about the fact that, you know, he made the claim that Russia is committing massive war crimes, to quote him. And he was speaking specifically in relation to what's happening in Mariupol. So, you know, he said it's going to be a very long day. There's a lot of things on the agenda. But as you mentioned, one of the key items is to prepare for possible new sanctions in the area of energy. And this is very, very significant because, as we know, in the EU, we get 27% of our oil and 40% of our gas from Russia. And it's reciprocally, it's a very important agreement that's been going on for years. I mean, Russia makes huge money from supplying this energy. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, the EU is very dependent. It's a very massive element to keeping the EU's economy afloat, is to have this sort of cheap gas coming in particular. But also, I mean, I think that's why they're talking about oil, because if they put some sort of restrictions on imports of oil into the EU, it would have a less damaging effect on the EU itself. But it opens up the question of how Russia might respond.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has congratulated the nation on the beginning of the Persian New Year. The leader has named this year production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. The leader said productions accompanied by those two characteristics will lead to tangible progress for the country. Ayatollah Khamenei also pointed to the highs and lows of the previous Iranian year. He cited the public turnout at the presidential election, despite the COVID pandemic raging at the time, as one of the sweet points. The leader said Iran's scientific and technological progress, including the development of COVID vaccines and launching of satellites, was another peak. Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. admission that it had suffered a humiliating defeat in its maximum pressure campaign against Iran was another success for the nation. However, he expressed disappointment at issues plaguing the livelihood of the Iranians, including high inflation, and called for their resolution. Political commentator Abbas Aslani believes that Iran has neutralized the U.S. sanctions because it has been able to boost domestic production in the face of foreign pressure.
Iranian administration and government have had two policies in the face of the sanctions by the West, specifically by the United States. One has been to neutralize the sanctions, which has been the main and major policy on the agenda. And the second has been to use the diplomatic tools in order to, let's say, get rid of the economic hardship or the sanctions. For the fourth executive year, we are seeing that the Iranian leader is using the word production and the term production in naming the Iranian years. And this indicates that he has made a lot of, let's say, emphasis on economic aspect of the agenda that the administration can have in the coming year. So this is part of, let's say, the policy to neutralize the sanctions. You know, Iran has been under enormous amount of sanctions under the so-called maximum pressure by the United States, in particular at the time of the pandemic. Why Iran was able to, let's say, survive this pressure? Because the country has been trying to somehow stress the domestic production and to somehow to make it powerful in the face of those economic pressure coming from the outside.
The U.S. has transferred a significant number of Patriot missile interceptors to Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. That's to help the kingdom against retaliatory attacks from Yemen. A senior U.S. administration official says the decision is in line with President Joe Biden's promise that Washington will have the backs of its friends in the region. Earlier this year, Riyadh requested for a resupply of interceptor missiles for its U.S.-made Patriot batteries. Yemeni forces have recently ramped up their retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia in response to its deadly war on the country. The supply of missile interceptors by the U.S. comes as Biden had promised to end the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Syria's President Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first official visit to an Arab state in over a decade. There, he received a warm welcome from Emirati rulers. During those meetings, Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan called Syria, in his own words, a fundamental pillar of Arab security. And those are strong words of support from the UAE, which until years ago was backing a full insurgency in Syria to push Assad out of power.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements.
Well, the U.S. has expressed profound disappointment at Assad's visit to the UAE, calling it the Emirates' attempt to legitimize the Syrian president. The development comes at a time when Arab countries like the UAE, Lebanon, and Jordan are keen to do business with Syria, but harsh U.S. sanctions like the CSAR Sanctions Act are preventing full-fledged trade.
Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies, has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
they have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian current money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars, which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that.
Another shocking video of police brutality in the United States. An off-duty cop in the state of Wisconsin is under investigation after he was found kneeling on a 12-year-old schoolgirl's neck to restrain her. The video taken at a school in Kenosha on March 4th shows Officer Sean Guchow handcuffing the girl after putting his knees on her neck amid a lunchtime fight. School officials released surveillance footage of the incident. The girl's attorney has said she couldn't breathe while the cop was pressing her neck. Guchow, a part-time security guard at the school, later resigned from his role but is still employed by the city's police department. The U.S. has a long history of police brutality against people of color. African Americans have been mostly the victims of U.S. police brutality, which in some cases has cost them their lives. Nationwide protests have been frequently held to condemn biased treatment of black people by U.S. police. Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye for now, everybody.
With the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health. Economic divide.
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has wreaked havoc in global oil markets. Russia plays a pivotal role in the global energy supply, and destabilization could send shockwaves to the global economy. It is the third biggest producer of oil in the world, behind the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Produces around 7 million barrels of oil per day, which is about 7% of global oil supply. Russian imports account for 8% of total U.K. oil demand. More than 40% of what it produces every day goes to Europe. The U.S. is less reliant, with about 3% of its imported oil coming from Russia. Oil prices have reached their highest levels in years. Experts warn sanctions on Russia's energy products could be catastrophic for the global economy. They say the global economy could be facing one of the largest energy supply shocks ever. There are now warnings that prices of oil per barrel could reach $180 to $200.
Here in the United States, I mean, we've imported 200,000 barrels a day. We imported about 450,000 barrels of product, mostly unfinished distillate, that we run through the refinery to boost yields on the other end of the refinery. It comes out more distillate, more gasoline. We don't really need those 200 barrels. We don't need those 450,000 barrels. So we can definitely exist without that. It's a spit in the bucket. The Eurozone, we're talking percentage points, double digits. So it's a totally different game.
Russia has already warned that prices could reach $300 per barrel if the West decides to shun its oil and gas from the markets. Supply shortages, bottlenecks, and price pressures caused by the coronavirus pandemic have already disrupted the global economy, and there are fears that further price shocks would have catastrophic consequences. The whole notion of sanctioning a country is to make the governing body suffer, and not the ordinary citizens. But that may not be the case when it comes to the U.S. in particular, than the Europeans. Let's see what people had to say about that in our social media section of the program. Well, this person has the right idea, even though the U.K. is too entrenched in this already. The U.K. should stay out of the Russia-Ukraine war, apart from that, to de-escalate and then try to bring in or bring the fighting to an end. Do not enact a no-fly zone, do not send weapons, and stop ramping up sanctions against all of Russia. That only hurts ordinary people rather than what he or this person says is the regime there. Next one, what a display of duplicity and hypocrisy of Europe's leaders. How can they expect Russia to supply gas, fuel, while their non-military entities, artists, sportspersons, ordinary people are being hit by sanctions? How will Germany or Hungary pay for energy with no SWIFT links? Next one, we do not support Joe Biden's sanctions on Russia. Sanctions will only hurt ordinary Americans by further hiking up gas prices. Biden's already slashed domestic production, and the Saudis have declined to raise output. Well, this new sanctions package will cripple America, not Russia. And finally, you're hurting Americans at the pump. Your sanctions are going to hurt us more than Russia, and the only ones in Russia that would be hurt are ordinary people there, just like the ones that you're hurting here at home. Open up the pipelines and drop all federal fuel taxes. Okay, some of the social media posts which seem to agree with us in terms of how ordinary people are suffering. Okay, joining us in this segment of the Q&A is Attilio Boron. He's a political scientist and international analyst who joins us from Buenos Aires. Attilio Boron, welcome. We're taking a look at, obviously, what has happened with this conflict, Russia's military operation, which has shocked the oil markets. Looking for replacements has been something that the U.S. is after, but it hasn't been successful. In the meantime, obviously, Europe is wanting to go with the U.S., but finding a replacement for oil and gas is a tough thing. What is your assessment as to whether this can be done to help the ordinary people who are suffering the most here?
Not at all. The world is hungry and thirsty of consuming oil, so there will be no problem for the Russians. Of course, there will be will be necessary to make some adjustments in all the pipelines which Russia has developed, but there is no question that they could divert the proportion, a high proportion at least, of the oil that they were exporting to Russia to the south.
That's indeed going to be a challenge also. Our next guest, Carlos Martinez, joins us from London. He is an activist and political analyst. Carlos Martinez, welcome to the program. If we were to take a look at an ulterior motive that the U.S. may have on this, it has pointed to its shale gas. And, of course, that involves fracking. But we know the hazards that are involved with that environmentally. At the same time, the inferior quality that consists of shale gas. How can that even be used to provide shortages, for example, in the case of Europe? Is that even feasible?
Yeah, it's a really important question that's been largely ignored, actually. You know, with the advent of fracking, hydraulic fracturing of shale rock, the U.S. has gone from being an energy importer to being an energy exporter. Now, in terms of the current crisis in Europe, that has a couple of consequences. Firstly, the US isn't really worried so much about sanctioning Russian energy because it's not reliant on it. Secondly, the US gets a positive benefit because it means a bigger market for US energy. That's why the US has been for years trying to scupper the Nord Stream 2 project, because they don't want to see Europe dependent on Russian energy, and they do want to see Europe dependent on American energy. Obviously, for European consumers, this turn to shale is a disaster because fracking is much more expensive. And to be transported across the Atlantic, fracked gas has to be converted to liquid. It has to be stored at, you know, maybe minus 60 degrees centigrade, pumped thousands of kilometers. So that's an expensive process.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we searched and are now ready to present to you some economic news from around the world. Well, you guessed it. It's hard to look for economic news where the Russia-Ukraine conflict is not involved, like this particular piece of news that comes from the UK. UK farmers are warning that soaring gas costs could cut food production. Farmers there are looking at a drop of up to 50% in the amount that they can afford to grow because of the soaring energy costs that are happening in that country. Of course, that's something that the UK is going to be grappling for quite some time. Moving out to the next topic here, premature pullout is the title we've given it. That could be the case of foreign companies that pulled out of Russia. Russia announced it plans to seize assets of Western companies that have pulled out of the country. The Russian President Vladimir Putin preparing economic retaliation for Western sanctions. That includes laws to impound $10 billion of leased airline jets. Russia said it could take temporary control of the departing businesses where foreign ownership exceeds 25%. All right, up to the next crisis. West Asia and North African countries are facing a severe wheat crisis over the Ukraine crisis. West Asia and North African countries are relying, well, they rely heavily on wheat imports from Russia and also from Ukraine, with around 70% of its wheat coming from both of those countries. Some 80% of Tunisia's grain also hails from these two countries. Lebanon, 60% of its wheat comes from Ukraine, so you can see how that obviously spells disaster for those countries when it comes to wheat. Argentina has had a fallout with the IMF before over loans and defaulting on it, but both are eager to get back into it again. But why? In which you have a $45 billion IMF loan that IMF has agreed with that country. Again, there have been loan defaults from Argentina. There was a case back in 1994 where they were heavily involved in a feud when it came to the fact that Argentina felt its sovereignty was violated. The government was going to default on a $19 billion repayment. That's part of the reason why it actually went for that loan. Well, those were the stories that we thought would be okay for this program for us to cover.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
When it comes to the U.S. sanctions on Russia, the U.S. went from being somewhat in doubt or hesitant about sanctioning Russia's oil and energy sector. And then from that, it went to a full-fledged trade embargo. Full-fledged, that meant no Russian imports and no trade with Russia. But at what cost? Did the U.S. really think about that? Well, we're going to be taking a look at some of those aspects. First, we're going to pose this question. How do U.S. sanctions on Russia affect the West? Well, this... the only way to look at it is through the numbers, and here you have one of them. Russia's oil and gas exports account for 25% of global exports. That's a quarter of global exports Russia accounts for. Next up, the impact on the U.S. It imported an average of over 20.4 million barrels of crude oil and refined petroleum products from Russia, and that was each month for the year 2021, which accounted for 8% of U.S. liquefied fuel imports. As a result, you're looking at an average gasoline price, $4.07 per gallon nationally. Insiders in the industry are concerned if it hits $200 per barrel, we may be looking at prices at the pump even going higher than that. And that's a possibility. Inflation is now a concern. The U.S. CPI surged to 7.5% in January, the fastest annual rise in 40 years, with sanctions on Russia putting more pressure, obviously, on inflation. Food, electricity, and shelter, the biggest drivers of inflation. Energy prices, as you can see, up 27%. and Goldman Sachs saying that if oil reaches $150 per barrel, we're looking at even more when it comes to energy costs. Now the EU. Russia is the largest single energy source in the EU. If Russian gas exports are banned, it's going to be tough to bring in it to bring it from other places. A third of the EU's natural gas and a quarter plus of its crude oil comes from Russia also. There are different aspects to this. But who is going to bear the most brunt, the worst part of it? Germany, the largest economy in Europe. More than half of Germany's natural gas and over 30% of its crude oil supply comes from Russia. Germany has come out along with the EU making a statement that perhaps they're going to put the brakes on banning Russian oil, and they may go in phases. Who knows? There's still a little on one side or the other when it comes to the way that they're going to approach this. Okay, people are bearing the brunt of this. That is what we're focusing on. And here is a case in point, which we obviously are going to take a look at the average people in the U.S. and what they think about what is happening regarding the oil prices and, of course, the conflict in Ukraine.
Not good. The price of gas has gone up, but for this, I got an 8-cylinder engine in here, and I use about $20 every 2 days to try to. I just try to get as much miles as I can out of what I'm doing, you know. But gas prices are going to go up,
and the increase of the gas is keep increasing every day. It's keep going up, and the jobs are going to be decent, going down every day. It's going down.
This is a special coverage of a live event.
Well, dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program to have the live coverage of the televised speech of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the occasion of the first day of the new Iranian calendar year. Let's take a listen.
Day of the century and the first day of the new year, I would like to begin my speech with someone who is a spring for all souls. Some verses from the Holy Quran. And I would like to say hello. To the 12th Imam of Shia Muslims. This is the third Nowruz that we, which I mean I myself, am not honored to be in Mashhad and at the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. And to deliver my speech to the pilgrims who travel there during the new year. Therefore, from a long distance, I would like to say hello to the 8th Shia Imam, Imam Reza. Peace be upon him. About the Iranian Nowruz at the beginning of the year and when spring begins, there are several issues that I have mentioned, but there is one thing that I would like to point out today, and it is the integration of this national Eid and celebration with prayers and spirituality. Probably among all of the celebrations, New Year's celebrations in different societies, this is very rare to celebrate a national New Year's celebration with spirituality and prayers and trying to get closer to God. Last night, at the turn of the year, people from all walks of life, from elders, scientists, people who are active in all different sections of the society, scientists, and even the youth, especially those who are working very hard in remote villages trying to serve the people who live there. Everyone started the new year with a New Year's prayer. They talked to God and they tried to get closer to God at the turn of the new year. Another important point about Nowruz is the special taste that Iranians have. It is something that makes you think deeper. And actually, spring is considered a symbol of hope. It brings a message of hope. Spring tells us that autumn and winter will definitely go and they will be over. And this is what spring means. It brings you a message that new things and new beginnings are around the corner. And of course, this hope was even more special because it coincided with the birthday of the biggest hope of humanity, the birthday of the 12th Shia Imam. And I would like to take this opportunity and say that people who usually address people and send messages, please try to promote hope because this is what keeps people going. Thank God. God has created the situation for Iranian people to be more hopeful about the future. Our resources are abundant, and let us make our enemies suffer by seeing us so hopeful. The first thing I would like to mention in this speech today is the economy. And yesterday, in my New Year's address, I did mention some points regarding that. And there are also some other issues I would like to discuss. The reason why the economy is something that I would like to point out on the first day of the new year is because of the importance of this issue. Meaning that if economy and justice together, if they go hand in hand, they provide the ground for progress and development. And the economy plays a very important role in this regard. And over the past 10 years, we confronted lots of economic challenges. And we should discuss and make better decisions regarding the economy and act upon those decisions in order for the population to be more comfortable in their lives. And this is why I would like to discuss the economy. And as far as the economy is concerned, national production is the most important issue. Over the past 3 or 4 years, I have repeated that. And, of course, the governments and officials, considering the situation that they've had, they've tried their best in order to make progress in this regard. But today, the most important issue, in my opinion, is that our executive officers and those who are involved should pay attention to the economy. And we see some new prospects, of course, and the presence of people. And if this continues, it is actually a sign that we should be even more hopeful. Another issue I would like to point out right now, most of the issues I bring up in my speech, I would like to point out that I'm addressing those who are in charge, the executive officers. I am trying to address those who can actually act upon this. And why do I address them in a public speech? It is because I want the society and the population to know exactly what I am asking the government officials to do. I want them to know about these decisions and also support these decisions. And, of course, people themselves also have certain duties. And there are several sectors where the population should take part. And, of course, this public address also allows these government officials to pay more attention. In order for our economy to progress and to develop, we should definitely move towards science-based knowledge and an economy which is based on that. What do I mean by that? That is asking people who are knowledgeable in this regard to be active in production and also in the production sector of the economy. Choosing a certain line of business based on science and knowledge within the sector of production. And if we pursue this policy and incorporate knowledge and science in the economy and pay more attention and support knowledge-based and science-based businesses, it will not only reduce our expenses, especially expenses in the production sector, and the quality of our products will be higher, and our products will be able to compete on the international level. And of course, also in our country, within our borders, even if we don't put too much taxes on imports, if the quality of our products are good, they will be successful in the market. Another issue I would like to give you as an example is the agriculture sector, which is a bit farther than the industry from knowledge-based businesses. And if we increase this type of businesses and incorporate knowledge in our agriculture sector, for example, that would allow us to find newer and incorporate technology in irrigation, and also it could allow us to make better use of our water and soil, which are two very important pillars in agriculture. And if we can develop our agriculture center to this level, it will not only allow us to have food security, and this means that we won't have to worry about providing food for our nation. And secondly, our farmers will have more income. And it is important for our farmers to have an increase in their income, because that will allow them to provide us with better produce. And also, we can solve the issue of water scarcity that we are facing right now in the country. Generally speaking, it is always said that we have this problem of water scarcity. But with knowledge and science, we can solve that. This was just an example, but in all the other sectors of the economy, production, services, this can increase the quality and reduce the price, and therefore going towards a knowledge-based economy is a very important issue that as I've said before, one of the problems is that we do not get back as much as we invest in different sectors of the society. So it is important, and I have talked about this before a couple of years ago, When I was in the holy city of Mashhad a few years ago, I talked about energy, and I said that, for example, the amount of power that we use, we don't get anything back as much as we use. It is not proportionate to the amount of electricity that we use. But if we do move towards a knowledge-based economy, this problem will be solved. So in order to move towards a knowledge-based production sector, there are several technical issues which may not be appropriate for me to bring up in a public address like this one. And government officials involved in this sector should follow up and try to reach the level of development. And also, it is important for this to eventually lead to eradicating poverty. And the only way to do so is to increase production. And this will be achieved. Second, regarding a knowledge-based approach, well, there are already several steps that have been taken, but we should increase. And at the moment, we have less than 7,000, about 6,600 or 6,700 knowledge-based companies in our country. And out of these, 4,500 are active in the production sector. And they have created 300,000 jobs, which is a good number. And I've asked experts in this field. Of course, it is more than 300, maybe 320,000. Or this is actually direct jobs, jobs that are directly created by these knowledge-based businesses. I asked them, how can we increase, to what level can we increase this number in the year 1401? And they told me that about 30% increase is something that we could expect to happen, but I am not happy with that. This is not a number that would be appropriate for our country. What I am expecting is a 100% increase. It means I want this number to be doubled. So the 300,000 jobs have to increase to 600,000 jobs in 1401. Of course, this should not lead to creating companies that are not knowledge-based. Our government officials should do their best, and especially in sectors such as the agricultural sector that I just mentioned, which are less developed. In this sector, only 4% of knowledge-based companies are active in the agricultural sector. which is so important, and I've just mentioned. Farming and agriculture is very important, and basic food products is something that we need to be self-sufficient in. Regarding wheat and food that we need to provide in our farming sector for farms, and also oil, producing oil and wheat and barley and all of these basic foodstuff. We have to be self-sufficient in producing these, and we are in a position where we can do so. We have fertile lands in different parts of our vast country, and we can work on that. About the province of Khuzestan, I had asked certain measures to be taken. The same thing happened about the province of Ilam. Of course, it was not to the level that I expected and the level I was promised that it would, but development should be seen in these provinces. And I would also like to point out that our president, Mr. Raisi, when he traveled to one of the foreign countries, and he was told that whatever number of watermelons and other agricultural products that you produce, we will buy them. And our president was surprised and said, why would you want to buy these products from us? You already have enough land to plant them yourself. And he realized that the policy in those countries was to plant wheat and barley. So those lands were dedicated to farming wheat, which is considered basic food products. Unfortunately, our agricultural sector, our nation should know, is that unfortunately we waste a lot of bread. Our people should know that our agriculture sector, unfortunately, is one of the most dependent sectors on imports. And our agriculture sector depends too much on imports. And we have to fight this dependency, which is a tough fight, because those who are importing these things, they usually stand against that. An example is colza oil. And there were different interpretations, and eventually I was told that there are certain groups and people who won't allow us to be independent. And they even use government offices. And this is a tough challenge that we should face. So the first of the two issues that I mentioned today is that the number of knowledge-based businesses is very small, and it has to increase, especially in the field of agriculture and, of course, all the other sectors. And government officials should support that, because these knowledge bases